Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You are too slow. You're lazy. You're not good enough. You haven't taken off that weight you promised. I'm sure many of you have heard that voice inside your head and carry it with you. It's a pretty portable voice. We all have them. They are our inner critic. They can be immobilizing. This feedback loop, though, can be helpful. It can be constructive when we give ourselves honest criticism, but it also can be paralyzing. So is it possible to draw the line between motivation and self-destruction? And we know the cure for that inner critic is self-acceptance, but that's easier said than done. Today we're having an open show about that inner critic, and we'd like to hear from you. I want to hear what you have to say. Do your own self-judgments make your life harder, or do they help you promote healthy goals? Join the conversation on Twitter. We are on Twitter, waiting to hear from you. Tag posts, hashtag voices, or call us. Have your inner critic call us. We're at 888-477-9499. We are ready for you and your inner critic. Joining me now is Dr. Molly Layton. She's a psychologist in private practice in Philadelphia. She and I, along with Michael Bame, recently completed teaching a course on mindfulness for psychotherapists at the Penn Program for Stress Management. We had a ball. I think it was helpful. Molly, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So I want to give the phone number again, 888-477-9499. Molly, I was watching my producers on the other side of the screen when I gave out the Twitter tagline. I screwed it up horribly because I'm of the wrong generation and they're over there laughing.
Well, so, me too. I listened to that and thought, what?
Yeah, so.
Oops.
So now I'm beating myself up.
Because, you know, and I'm not beating myself up.
So let's start with this. With this inner judge.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Well, I actually think that it starts at a very young age. Most people start around the age of 5 and 6. You know, when they're starting to kind of wake up in a certain way. I think it's a developmental thing, and they actually start to develop strategies for guiding themselves through this world or helping themselves through. And then what I find years later is they come into my office and they've still got the same strategy that they devised as a 5 or 6 year old, strategy like be a good girl. Or don't upset the family, you know, and they were very adaptive strategies at one point, but then they've become very rigid, and they don't go back to inspect those strategies, and that there they are inside their head, kind of pounding away.
So does everybody have this critical voice? Is it?
I think
obviously, it's worse with some than others.
Right. I think, it's worse with some than others. And some people are growing up in households in which things are so distorted that, you know, they never get access to being able to think a lot about what's a better strategy. You know, what's a better way to handle, say, being, bullied by somebody in the third grade, something like that. You know, they don't have anybody to talk to. They don't revise their strategies. But there's something about a kind of fascination that we all have with negativity, and there's something about how we want to regulate ourselves so that it's really an effort to avoid negativity, which paradoxically ends up giving us a lot of negative experience.
Well, that's the way the brain works. I mean, if you know, we go into an ornate room that's breathtaking and picture perfect, but there's a tile missing on the ceiling, that's where our eyes are going to go over and over again.
Exactly. Right. The one little bit of criticism comes through with this enormous amount of power. And then we do it. But there's something sort of exponential about it. There's something that sort of keeps increasing about negativity, so that it becomes the default mode. It becomes the only thing that has salience for us, and it is quite torturous. It's very surprising how much torture, internal torture, people will tolerate. And then if somebody walked up to them and said those very things to them, you know, they'd punch them out. But if they had that, they have that kind of internal torture going on, is something that is not questioned.
Yeah, it's interesting. It really is about a relationship. Let me invite our listeners or pose a question to the listeners. Call in and tell us your relationship with you. Is it ambivalent? Is it loving? Is it filled with hatred? And how long has that relationship been that way? Our number is 888-477-9499. I'd love to hear that relationship with you. 888-477-9499.
For example, is it trustworthy? Is your relationship with yourself trustworthy? Can you trust your own judgment to be guiding, to be helpful, to be in touch with reality?
All right, so this raises another question.
Right.
Most people I know are nicer to other people than they are to themselves.
Yes, there's certainly a big group of people that are nicer to other people than they are to themselves, right?
Why?
Well, it's that whole thing about trying to regulate their own behavior. The operating principle is, say, for example, to be nice to other people. But to do that, they're operating out of some kind of having to whip themselves into shape to be nice to other people. In other words, they don't actually trust their inherent enjoyment of other people, pleasure in other people.
Well, I've got to raise a question here before all of our analyst friends go into apoplexy here, because you know, this voice is also a parental voice. I mean, I recall my mother saying, right, talking about being nice to others and don't be selfish. I remember hearing that mantra.
Sure, right.
So is that the origin of the judge? Is it our parents?
I think it's one of the origins. It definitely is, you know, because you get this, you get these parental instructions about how to live in the world. But we also devise our own. We devise our own. We do. Do you know that when I'm just thinking of a woman I knew who devised the instruction to herself. She didn't know it was she did not know it was an instruction, but it turned out to be instruction, which was to that she was not important and she had to get out of the way whenever the disruptions in the family started. Now, nobody turned to her and said, "You're not important." But that by having to withdraw herself, hide herself, she somehow came up with the idea that she's not important. And that seemed to be a pretty adaptive strategy for years and years and years. Got her out of the family dishevelment, the family uproar.
Where many people feel they're too important in a negative kind of way, and that if they open their mouth, they'll make things worse in the family.
Oh, right. Exactly.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Justin on the line. Justin, hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Good. What can we do for you?
I was just it's funny that you have this thing. I feel like I'm talking to myself. I'm a very self-critical individual. I grew up in a sort of dysfunctional family with addictions and what have you, and you know, divorce. And I always acted out. And I almost have a narcissism and a self-criticism that are of equal power, sometimes it feels like, and a very ruminating personality. So I think you know, sometimes with the obsessing and constantly looking, you know, for perfection and to find a place to apply that negativity almost feels like it. You said feedback loop is a great way of describing it. I'm just curious if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, wait a minute. I've got a silly question to ask, Justin. How come you do that?
How come? Because I'm not good at living in the moment.
Oh, come on. Come on, that's a psychology answer. It's the right one. But, you know, come on. Yeah, like, why do you do that?
Why do I do, and why the self-criticism?
Yeah, why do you, how come?
I don't know. I see a therapist, so, you know, I've been working through some of the things and trying to focus when those times come, but I don't know why. It's, you know, it's almost a reaction. My first reaction when something good happens is to think, okay, now what is going to happen? What, how could this go bad, and how do I prevent it?
Yeah.
No, don't do anything stupid now.
Oh, there you go. Don't do anything stupid.
And you're going to find some way to screw this up.
Right. So it sounds like so far it's a strategy for protecting yourself from being stupid.
Yeah, should be.
So that's one of the reasons you do it, is so that you don't have to look or feel stupid.
Right.
If you can monitor your body, your emotions while you're doing this, oftentimes that critic is the voice of anxiety. And the anxiety is saying, if you do this the right way, then you won't feel anxious. Then the anxieties will go away. Then you'll be okay. Then you'll be fine. You jump through these hoops, do this the right way, and then the anxiety will go away.
Which is, and then I've developed a lot of, personally, I have a lot of little routines that I do to stop myself from making common mistakes that I've made before.
Right.
That's what you're looking to do. I mean,
right.
it's almost like someone with OCD or any other anxiety disorder. It's the OCD is an effort to make the anxiety go away.
Sure.
Which
right?
is actually, that's my diagnosis. But I think when you combine that with the sort of the editor, the self-critic you're talking about, it builds that a louder feedback loop. It becomes, you know,
right.
preventing the anxiety on top of trying to perfect the behavior.
And it is all about trying to manage your anxiety. Right?
Yep.
How's that worked so far?
Well, now when I'm talking to two professionals, I feel better. But it's not great. You know, it's like anything else. There's always something that comes around. That's what I've learned.
All right.
Well, listen, but I have a suggestion for you. Right, and I am a trained professional. All right, so I have this suggestion for you, which is that, and I bet Dan would agree with me about this, I think you need to practice being stupid. I think you need to be able to explore that a bit more. I don't mean by explore it, by kind of try to justify it or excuse yourself or anything like that. It's like, I think you've got to really, really allow yourself to feel stupid. And not avoid that feeling and even go down into what it feels like inside yourself, inside your body even, and because you're spending a lot of energy trying not to feel stupid.
You know, my greatest therapeutic experience I've had in my life, and this is to Justin and Molly,
uh-huh.
as a patient, the greatest,
uh-huh.
it wasn't with all the years of therapy and thousands of dollars of therapy. It wasn't that. I did a talk show many years ago
mm-hmm.
with a group of, it was one of these Saturday afternoon talk shows, and it was with a group of kids who interviewed a, quote, expert.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an expert then on substance abuse. My wife at the time was with me, and she was in the engineer's booth. And a kid asked me a question, and I didn't know the answer. And I said, I don't know. I said, I'll tell you what, though. I said, I'll look it up over the weekend and give me a call Monday or I'll call you. And I didn't think anything of it. And my wife said after the show that the engineer was blown away by that. He said he'd never heard an expert say he didn't know. And he thought it was great television. And that was the first time in my life I got permission, not more than permission, to say I don't know.
Mm.
It was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Justin, I make a point every day to say, I don't know. And that was over 30 years ago, and that's worked out pretty well for me because there's lots I don't know.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you know, hey, Justin, I really do want to ask you. So would you be willing to tolerate being a little bit stupid now and then?
No, I'd be happy to try.
Yeah, I mean, with all of us and our fears, you know, we are not as smart as we think we should be, and we're not as stupid as we fear we are.
Exactly.
We're right in the middle. Justin, we have to go take a break. I wish you the best. I wish you great pleasure in your life, and thanks so much for your call.
I want to add something later, okay, when we get a chance.
Okay.
Okay.
We're talking about our inner judge. Our lines are filled, but be patient. Keep trying. It's 888-477-9499. My guest is Dr. Molly Layton. She's a psychologist in private practice here in Philadelphia. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Newman College, now Newman University, proudly supports WHYY. As a university, Newman will continue to offer undergraduate degrees in a range of majors, master's and doctoral programs, and an accelerated bachelor's degree program for adults. They will provide opportunities for academic scholarship and research while maintaining the community atmosphere Newman students have come to know, including respect for individuals, concern for the environment, and social responsibility. Newman University. Newman.edu.
This week from NPR News, it's coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Join NPR's Linda Wertheimer at the end of each day for a one-hour summary of the day's proceedings with thorough analysis from NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. That's coverage of Judge Sotomayor's confirmation hearings this week from NPR News.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our critical inner judge. I wonder why. Joining me is Dr. Molly Layton. She's a psychologist in private practice in Philadelphia. She and I taught a course together with Dr. Michael Baim at the Penn Program for Stress Management. We just completed it, or we're on the tail end of it now, on mindfulness for psychotherapists. We had a blast. Molly's been a friend of mine. I don't even want to count how many years, but we've had lots of fun together over the years. So it's an open show. I want to hear from you about your inner critic. Molly, does the inner critic speak the truth?
Well, that's the problem with the inner critic. That's the, I think it's actually the inner critic is quite a barrier between ourselves and learning from our own experience. So like if Justin, the previous caller, was able to tolerate feeling stupid, I think he would start to notice that there was, that would open a door for him into a much larger experience of himself. And I can predict what it would be. Can't predict what it would be, because that would be...
Sure.
But he would start to realize that he'd been blocking a lot of other experience that he would label stupid. And he wouldn't actually be... I mean, it narrows his life to have... All of us. Not just Justin. It's all of us. It narrows our lives.
It's not just the inner critic that narrows our lives. Anytime we think we know the truth, it narrows our lives. Anytime we make assumptions, you know, that we know exactly the way things work, who we are, where we fit, as soon as we... have that rigid knowledge, the feedback loop is shot.
Right. You're right about that.
We're less open.
Yes, exactly.
Let's go back to the lines. We've got a lot of people want to join us. We'll start with Harry. Harry, hi. You're on the air.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing okay. This subject could not be closer to me than anything. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, very well.
I just to answer a question you posed at the beginning of the show, like I have a self-judge in my head that has been with me since I can remember having a self, you know, since I was a child. And I'm in my 40s, and I struggle with it constantly. It has definitely challenged relationships, like with, you know, people in my life, and continues to do so. And on this last thing you were talking about knowing the truth, that has always been or a growing concern with me. If I don't even trust my own judgment, I don't trust what I feel for others, and I don't necessarily trust how they feel. So
you're really suffering here. You're really.
And it's funny. Yeah, it's funny because I'm actually driving to my therapist right now for a 1 o'clock appointment.
You talked a lot about relationships. Tell us, are you holding the phone or are you on a hands-free? I don't want to be an accomplice to your getting a ticket here.
Oh, no, I'm fine. Thank you.
So, Harry, tell us about your relationship with your inner judge.
My relationship with my judge, he drives me crazy because anytime I get involved in a relationship, and I've been very blessed to have several really incredible relationships.
No, wait a minute. You're not answering my question. I'm going to be tough on you, so
I'll that's fine.
All right. I don't want to know what your judge does to you.
Okay.
I want to know about your relationship. You were called it a he. So you've been with this guy for 40 years. I want to know about your relationship with him.
I'm not sure how to answer that. He just bothers me because he is a constant voice in my head that is always questioning or, you know, what I'm doing or what I'm thinking and or feeling.
All right. At the risk of making you crazy here, how does he feel about you? How do you feel about him?
I think I feel like I fall short all the time of whatever, you know, I'm involved in. Whether it's a relationship or a job, I never do quite what I'm supposed to do. I never live up to the expectations.
Does your judge hate you?
I don't know if he hates me, but he dislikes me a great deal.
There's no affection there at all?
No, I don't think there is, actually.
And how do you feel about him?
I guess I don't hate him. I just wish he would shut up.
All right. Let me continue to be annoying here, okay?
Oh, please.
You said you don't hate him, but you didn't tell me how you feel about him.
How do I feel about him? I don't trust him. But at the same time, I listen to him, you know, and kind of move through my life more listening to this voice, not to suggest it's a voice in my head, but listening to this guide and not sure if he's pointing me in the right direction.
Right.
Molly?
Yeah, Harry, Dan's pointing out something that maybe you can find very useful, which is he's pointing out that often this the critical piece is a one-way street. You're listening to him, but you don't particularly know how well, whether you can trust this guy. We'll say guy, because at this point we're kind of taking this voice, which you would probably ordinarily think of as just your thinking. And what Dan is doing is he's helping you separate that out from, and as it being a separate thing going on. So that it's not just your thinking. There is some automatic, and think of it as not quite you, because Dan's inviting you to think about this as something that you can think about. You can think about, well, what do I think about this guy? And that's really pretty important. There ought to be a little daylight between you and this, the automatic quality of this thinking, right?
Yeah, and I wouldn't emphasize that I think of this as like a separate entity or voice. I do think a lot, and actually my girlfriend will tell me that I think too much, and you probably hear that. A lot of people have somebody say that to them.
Well, I don't, Harry, I don't know anybody that probably doesn't think too much. And contrary to current research, I don't think you really can control your thinking. But what Molly and I are asking you to do is to think about your thinking.
Right.
Now, I know that statement is a little crazy-making, but just kind of step outside your mind and take a look at the way your mind is functioning. Just take a look at this interaction between you and your judge. I mean, what are you guys doing with each other? What's this dance about? How does this judge really feel about you? How do you feel about the judge? What's a 40-year relationship feel like? Just all these questions. When you ask these questions, you are out of your mind. In a literal sense. And
in a good sense.
And contrary to public opinion, that's good news.
Yeah, and I will say I am much like probably other people calling with this type of thing that they deal with. I write in a journal. I mean, I have a huge journal. I write constantly about it. And that, too, is the discussion. So I just get it on paper.
Well, that helps. It helps get it out of your mind. And the other thing that helps a good deal is engage in activities that bring you great joy and help you not think so much.
But the question is still operative here, which is if you have this judge inside yourself, what is the judge meant to be helping you do? What's it to guide you through? What's it to protect you from? What's its function?
Yeah, I think that's a question we all need to ask. We're going to have to move on, Harry.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and please drive carefully and give your therapist our best.
All right, thank you.
A good session. But Molly, you make a good point, and it's part of what I was asking for about the relationship with the judge, because you know, the judge feels and sounds harsh, but there's a quality in there where it's trying to give you guidance in a very naive, anxiety-based way, saying, "Let's do this, and maybe we'll feel better."
Exactly, you're right.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Laura on the line. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just wanted to call and thank you again. I've called your show before. I always say with most shows, I'm not going to call and talk because I just want to listen. But something you seem to do is make me want to share.
Well, great.
I can't hear you very well.
Oh, okay. Well.
Oh, there you are. Okay. I just wanted to share some of what I've been working through. I'm 47, and it was interesting when the woman said at 5 is an age when you become aware of things. And I remember at 5 starting to look at my mother's model and the model of my grandmother, and then very specifically, whether it was verbal or nonverbal, telling me to be invisible, to be a good girl, don't eat too much, don't make yourself too big, don't take up too much space in this world. And for most of my life, I've been working at being invisible and not taking up too much space. And when I do take something that's in my own interest, I feel like I'm stealing it. And in the last couple of years, through guidance with a counselor, I've come to look at that voice and see it critically. And in some ways, to be able to speak back to it and say, what you say to me isn't all true, and that's not a good thing, to be invisible. But at the same time, to be able to become friends with that voice. And I think the point that I'm at now is, how do I go to my mother? And in some ways, I feel a burden to help my mother see what she taught me and how in her late 60s, she's still living with that model and how crippling it is, and I want her to be able to see that. But for me, I feel like I'm growing out of it, but at the same time learning to accept that voice inside of me.
You're bringing so many issues up here. One of them is exquisitely feminine, because what you are describing now, although, you know, this inner critic, you know, is not gender specific, but what you're bringing up now is exquisitely feminine and generational issues. Molly?
I think so. And I thought, like, as I'm listening to you speak, I was thinking, oh, my God, what a project that you have to, like, be invisible. Like, it's impossible. So you're in this impossible project that actually alienates you from yourself. Okay, and so I was thinking that it's another thing now that you want to pass this on to your mother, and you want to have some kind of conversation about this with your mother, that sounds very interesting. Is your mother aware of what kind of experience you've had? Is she been interested in it?
No, she hasn't been interested in it. And once in a while, I'll say something to her, and she either goes on to the next subject, or she sounds like she's not understanding what I'm saying to her. I can't tell if she's avoiding the issue with me, or if it's just something she's just so unaware of.
Laura, let me make a suggestion, if I may, that what the work you're doing is wonderful, and it speaks in part to who you are, and it speaks in part to your generation, too. And your mother is of a different generation. I worry that your desire to help her is part of an old model that you might have carried from before.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of needing to help people, especially in your family, with what you perceive is suffering. But that's very different from sharing with her your excitement about where you are in your life and the growth you're experiencing. And if she's interested in that, great. And if she's not, that's fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's the painful part, is letting her be where she's at and accepting that and loving her no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. Okay? Thanks so much for your call, Laura. Well, we're going to take a short break, Molly, and when we come back, we've got lots of people who want to join the conversation about the inner critic. This really is a universal issue. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about the inner critic. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm with Dr. Molly Layton, a psychologist in private practice here in Philadelphia and a dear friend and colleague. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's here on WHYY FM.
In warm lagoons off the coast of Baja California, giant gray whales are approaching boats and playfully interacting with humans. The 30-ton creatures are making eye contact and letting people pet them. On the next Fresh Air, marine mammal behaviorist Tony Frohoff and writer Charles Siebert tell us what this trusting relationship reveals about the nature of whales. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Many parents teach their daughters to protect themselves against sexual predators, but should we be more aware of the dangers to our sons? Are adults more amused than appalled when the predator is a woman? In Behind Closed Doors, we'll try to understand the scope and the impact of the sexual abuse of boys. That's next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb with Molly Layton, who's a psychologist in private practice here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about the inner critic, something we all live with, something most of us suffer with. So the question is, really, what can be done about the inner critic? We talked earlier, Molly, about self-acceptance is the cure, but easier said than done.
Easier said than done, right. The self-compassion, self-acceptance. And most people have a kind of a prohibition even about self-acceptance. That's one of the tricks of this whole thing. They have a thing that feels it could be self-indulgent. It could be narcissistic. You're not supposed to think about yourself. You're supposed to think about other people.
Well, and how can I accept myself if I'm not good enough?
Right, exactly. But, you know, that all these things are part of the internal program that says you can't go down this path of accepting yourself, because that way lies, you'll make bad choices, your behavior will be out of control, you won't be kind to other people, me.
What does it mean, self-acceptance, really?
Well, that's a great question. What does self-acceptance mean?
I can't take credit for it.
Oh.
it was just programmed to me on the board by, I don't know if it was a Lisa Walters or Gita Simon.
Oh, Gita, so right.
What I is, just have to say.
But what does self-acceptance mean? I think of self-acceptance as basically kind of getting to know and love the instrument that you are, the creature that you are, the being that you are. That it's got not this is not love in a narcissistic way, namely in that you have to be perfect, and everything you think is, you know, you should get your way. But it's a kind of knowing the instrument. It would be like in a way. Did you see that movie, The Horse Whisperer, with Robert Redford, and how he. Here he was, this person that knew how to relate to this very skittish breed of animals. And in some way, we have to kind of be self-whisperers in a way. Namely, we have to understand ourselves. We have to be gentle with ourselves. And why do we do that? Because then we actually can come into, you know, effectiveness with other people and entitlement to walk around the face of this earth. We can be more of who we really are.
I had a supervisor years ago, I can't remember his name, who said the world is full of people trying to be filet mignon, and deep down we know we're meatballs. So self-acceptance, meat metaphors don't work real well these days, but self-acceptance is about, I hate to say this, but loving the meatball. I mean, that's metaphor abuse, but you get the point.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, you have to start with the meatball if that's what you are. Not that all this is part of a program of enormous self-improvement.
Yeah, and the meatball's not going to change. I mean, there's a, you know, you look under the bell curve. You look at the bell curve. You know, most of us are living under the big hump, you know, and we've got to find a way to make peace under the big hump. There's very few people on the edges there.
But I've got to say something about meatballs. What? Meatballs are wonderful.
That's my point.
They are.
That's my point. That's
and especially a well-made meatball.
That's
if we're going to continue in this
way. Let's go back to the phone so we can do something that resembles psychology here. We've got Leslie on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Leslie.
So I'm calling because I definitely did a lot of critical thinking for most of my life, and I'm now almost 52, and I've been in recovery from an eating disorder for the past 22 years, and what has enabled me to be in recovery is to stop the critical voices. And now I'm a teacher, and I work with my students, my elementary school students, in trying to help them use more constructive voices. And I think in hearing the discussion, I think what, for me, I differentiate between a critical voice and kind of helpful self-criticism is the difference between thinking I'm a bad person versus what I did was not really great. And that's a distinction that I think has really helped me.
Excellent.
That's so important.
Excellent.
Who you are versus what you've done.
Exactly.
But, you know, that allows you then to think about, well, did that work? Which
right.
is a great question to have in this life. Oh, I tried it this way. Didn't
right.
seem
like
to go so
well.
When
I used to binge, you know, I would be, like, afterwards so remorseful and hating myself and just, you know, thinking what a disgusting fat slob I was and what a, you know, unlovable, unworthy person. And now I've learned to say, like, oh, I ate too much. That doesn't feel so good. I don't want to do that again.
Right.
You know, it's a totally different.
So notice that by dropping out that critical voice, you had more access to your actual experience,
exactly.
which was, oh, that didn't feel so good
exactly.
physically in my body. And then you were able to use that.
No, exactly. And what I tell my kids is that we all have these little gremlins sitting on our shoulders telling us how horrible we are and that we need to tell them to be quiet. Like, for example, math gremlins are very popular. And so, you know, I tell them that, you know, this, that I, because I can watch their anxiety overcome them, and then they can't do the work. They can't, you know, they can't focus on what they're actually doing. So I help them try to recognize that those voices are not really very useful, but for kids it's really helpful to call it gremlins.
That's great. You know, there was a book written years ago. I think the author's name was Carson or Carlin, and the book was called Taming Your Gremlin. And it was a little paperback book with illustrations, and it was wonderful for people of all ages. Richard Carson or Carlin, Taming Your Gremlin. I wonder if it's still out. It was a great book. But, you know, the issue is taming it, not crushing it or eliminating it or you know, taking out its tongue and making it mute, you know?
Right, it's
about taming it. It's a part of us.
Because it'll pop up, but but then you've got to have some way to not get too fascinated by it.
Yeah. Right.
So to feel like that's the path. I need to be on this path of rigorous.
Yeah. The imagery of gremlin is just great. It's just great. Thanks so much for your call, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
You're doing great work.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Tara on the line. Tara,
yes,
hi.
Yes, hi, Dr. Gottlieb.
Hi.
It's a wonderful pleasure to listen to your program all the time, so thank you for all your programs.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I just wanted to state I would echo the sentiments of all the other callers that have called in today of just feeling a lot of self-punishment, guilt, not feeling good enough to receive, you know, anything in life. And yet there's always been, for me at least, a strange juxtaposition between the sense of feeling invisible and at the same time simultaneously wanting to express myself creatively in so many different ways. And recently I've been drawing a lot of mandalas and trying to maintain contact with that creativity that's within inside me. And so my comment would be that I often think sometimes when you lose your passion or if you're no longer pursuing your artistic passions or things that move you, sometimes that self-critic, which may have been constructive in the beginning, helping you through something, all of a sudden, maybe because the self-critic is bored or not receiving the juices it needs, but it becomes very damaging, in my opinion. So it's a strange transition between perhaps the self-critic that could be constructive in a couple ways of helping you progress further in what you're doing, and then all of a sudden becoming very destructive when that passion is no longer being fed.
Well, Molly, Tara seems to be addressing another manifestation of that boundary between.
Right. Exactly. That, you know, it's that you start to notice that the criticism is actually not very useful. It's automatic, but it's not very useful. And you actually get access to more of your thinking and more of the richness of what's going on inside yourself. Creativity is a great word to use here. If you're not being pestered. I remember when I first started writing, I was writing, and I would have I would get frozen in my writing because every time I would go to use a certain word, I would think, oh my goodness, this is the wrong word. I need to find a better word. And this would go every fourth or fifth word would be something I would have to agonize over. And then it would be too long a story to tell you what I needed to do then to develop a way of turning aside from that, oh, this is the wrong word. One of the things I did was I said, I'll just put in anything and I'll change it later. So I had to devise a lot of methods for not getting caught up. And then by doing that, I discovered it was almost like kind of an underground flow of thinking that was very rich. And then the surprising thing was that I never had to go back and change any of those words that I would have rejected. That was so interesting.
What do you mean the underground thinking, Molly?
There's a lot of thinking or sensibility that was much more available to me that once I cut out this kind of on the top, this epiphenomenon of everything being...
What I call it is small mind.
Small mind. Okay, that's great. Small mind. And then I was getting into large mind.
Right.
It's getting into large mind, right? That's a good way to put it.
The small mind is about me and the word and how am I going to be judged.
And you know what else? It's incredibly repetitive. Once I find myself thinking the same thing over and over again, the same negative thing over and over again in particular, I already know I'm in small mind,
right,
and I'm not going to get anywhere,
right,
except maybe to be miserable. And that because it's a very abrasive for the spirit. Do you know you create depression in yourself because you're tamping yourself down.
You know, Christopher Reeve said in one of his biographies after the accident, it was one little vignette. He said that every morning he gives himself about 20 minutes for self-pity. You know, he wakes up every morning and says, oh, look at what I have to live with. This is awful. This is terrible. And 20 minutes later, he says, okay, time's up. I got to go now. I got to go do my life. So, you know, when you find yourself in small mind, well, this is your time to visit small mind. This is where you are right now, but this is not where you live. You don't have to live here. You know, it's where you visit. Pay attention, just notice, and then move on. I want to see if we can get another caller on before we have to go, a caller or two. Let's go to Sharon on line 7. Sharon, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi. The reason I was calling is I relate very much to your topic, and I love your show.
Thank you. Me too.
I have been someone who suffered from depression from an early age, and it ran in my family. And I achieved a lot more than I thought I could. I went to Penn. I always felt dumber than most of the people around me. And I'm a person who isn't always very articulate. I mean, I can come off articulate in certain cases. In other cases, I'm totally frozen and anxious. And I'm right now in the middle of a course in restorative practices where we're talking a lot about stress and trauma and bringing up a lot of things that happened to us personally, as well as talking about things that happened in the world. I'm finding it extremely stressful to me. And I've listened to what you just said about the small mind. I feel like I'm stuck there, and I can't get past my own anxiety. And I'm wondering about suggestions for getting out of that, for dealing with a topic where you're facing it intellectually and emotionally, but not being able to get out of it.
Sharon, I got to tell you, my gut instinct is not to get out of it, that anxiety is holding some rich information for you, that there's something about this course activated something inside of you that's making you uncomfortable.
And absolutely.
It might be helpful to explore what it is. It's the possibility that there's the potential for healing something that has been living inside of you, laying dormant. Your thoughts, Sharon?
I think that's probably very true.
Why?
I'm just not sure where to go with it.
Let me ask Dan. Okay, so Dan, what did you hear in that made you think there's more than just having to, you know, stop, breathe, be, or something like that with these anxious?
When we have anxiety, anxiety is not always bad news.
No,
you know,
of course.
I wake up in the middle of the night and I forgot to pay my health insurance bill. You know, well, that's
big
constructive,
deal.
Right. Or, you know, sometimes I feel anxiety when I'm driving and I realize that I'm not sitting properly in the chair,
So it's a warning signal, or it's a sign that something is amiss.
Right.
And but were you hearing something in Sharon's voice?
Sharon's taking this course.
Yes, that's right.
And she was doing fine. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this anxiety comes up out of somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and like a colleague of mine once said, all buried feelings are buried alive. You know, they're going to come back somewhere. And you know, we talk to Sharon and this rings true to her mm-hmm. on a gut level.
Right.
And where do you go from there? You start talking and, you know, Sharon, you know, Molly and I are therapists, so we think in terms of therapy. I would imagine there's lots of other options, too. You know, talking to trusted friends or colleagues or maybe even teachers from the course. Your thought?
Yeah. Actually, the course description said be sure to set up a support network for yourself because it warned us that, you know, some of these things would be coming up. And my best friend just went on vacation.
Well,
for this particular week, I'm kind of left. Just thinking, you know, the past couple hours, I was thinking, well, who could I rely on right now, you know, as my support network? And then I
I appreciate being tagged if you're using the radio show as part of it.
Yeah.
But I would call your instructor.
Yeah.
You know, see where they would guide you. But
yeah.
don't get overwhelmed by your anxiety. It's a guide and it's an emotion. It's unpleasant, but it, you know, it's a guide and it's an emotion. It's not going to overwhelm.
Can I add one particular thing that is bothering me right now?
Very very quickly, because we've only got seconds.
Okay, the guy Dante Craddock who hit the three little kids and the mother.
Yeah.
He was a student of mine in sixth grade. I've had no contact with him since I left the school after that 1 year, but it's really bothering me.
We're not going to have time to talk about that in the detail that it deserves. But this might give you some insight. Please contact your instructor and mobilize that support system. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We are right up at the end. My guest today has been Molly Layton, a psychologist in private practice in Philadelphia. Next week, we've got a fascinating show. We're going to be talking about the portrayal of mental illness on TV. And you can join me at philly.com/askdan tomorrow for my live web chat on stepfamilies. So you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.